It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast, where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from Gadigal, Sydney.
And I'm Sarah D. Bunting, keeping the chair warm for Mari Forrest, who is on maternity leave, and I'm in beautiful Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, New York.
I have my particularly croaky throat. Thank you, flu. But let us proceed. Sarah, welcome to Crime Scene. We're so happy. And
oh, gosh,
it's so amazing to have you here filling in for Mari, stepping up.
I am delighted to be here, honored to be here. Very big shoes to fill, but I wear a 9.5, so I'm going to do my best.
I think we're both tall girls with the big feet. I wear a 10.
Mm-hmm.
So last week we watched the first episode of The Jinx, Part 2, with cold case investigator Sarah Kalin. There are 6 episodes altogether. They're dropping weekly on Max. Sarah, what are your thoughts on The Jinx, Part 2? We had a slightly mixed reaction, but generally cautiously positive.
That's pretty much how we felt over at Best Evidence. My esteemed colleagues, Eve Beatty, Andy Dennard, and I talked about it, I think the morning after the first couple of episodes had dropped, or the first one had dropped. We had seen the first 4. Check my screener privilege. I think cautiously optimistic is about right. We kind of came out that it's not essential for it to exist. And yet, because it's from this team, it is extremely well built and like it's a pleasing sit in terms of the construction. So even though like it seems to exist almost out of time, like in a before time from when the first one came out, and I think we thought of true crime differently, especially since this property, The Jinx Part 1, along with Serial and a couple of other properties in the mid-teens, like, you know, almost 10 years ago, sort of not reset the bar, but it did sort of like show us another path of prestige true crime narrative, like just storytelling and construction. So, you know, we trust the build from Jarecki et al., but it's also like true crime is different now. Like we're on the, not really on the other side of a pandemic, but for the purposes of moving on in this sentence.
Yes.
And, you know, 2020, that wasn't the only thing going on. There was really a lot of meta thought being given to who benefits from true crime, to who benefits from police-centered stories, and so on and so forth. I don't really have to explain to anyone listening to this how that went. So it was interesting to me on a meta level as someone who thinks a lot about how true crime is told and sold, that's why I'm here, to look at The Jinx Part 2 in the context of itself and to wonder whether it and its production team really understand when we are in the timeline of, quote, prestige true crime. That's all very, like, vague, but I mean, like, 4.5?
Yeah.
Magnifying glasses, I guess? I mean, yeah. It's good. I just think it doesn't know why it is, maybe. But
yeah.
I'm keep watching it. Are you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, Mari and I gave it a 4 and Sarah gave it a 3. I mean, side note, I'm getting as many Sarahs who podcast about true crime onto this show as I can.
Crime Sarah.
Mm. Crime Sarah. What did we say? All Sarahs, no bullshit. Maybe some bullshit. yeah. But we did talk about that idea of what's current about not just the story, but the way the story is told and the reflection of where and when we are now. It's very easy to have missed. Spoiler, he died 2 years ago.
Mm, yeah.
This was a surprise to 2 of the 3 on the panel. They accused me of spoiling them. I said it was in all the papers. But I myself had to look it up to remind myself that he had died. And in addition, the idea of we don't like stories that give, or rather, we don't like properties that give the perpetrator space and time and a platform to talk generally. Right. And yet, because it's the Jinx and because it's Bobby Durst, okay, bye-bye. There's an advantage to having a cold. My Bobby Durst is better. Okay.
This is a collect call from Bob.
Bob.
They talk about this actually in later episodes that he is this like weirdly cobwebbly charismatic character and always has been. And what do you, as an ethical true crime content producer, what do you do with that? Like, what can you do with that? Like, his whole deal is so fucking wild.
Mm.
Like, I get if not wanting to center him, but
yeah,
it's like he won't.
He won't be
won't let you not do it. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and Sarah and I had both rewatched the first 6 parts, and it's sort of definitely part of the family. It is essentially episode 7, you know. Mm-hmm. And I amused myself by wondering if the reenactment actor for Bobby was the same one as 9 years ago. That would have been a bit of a coup de théâtre. And I think I came to the conclusion, not so reluctantly as one would think, that yes, we do need to hear from him. Otherwise, we really can't understand the goings on, shall we say.
Well, I think it's also useful to remember, which I had forgotten, like the kind of chopped up jazz timeline that all of this was on and that they had started sitting and recording with him like in 2010 or something. Mm. And then I had completely forgotten the whole timeline with like, he was fixing to flee the country on the eve of the season finale of the first one. And like, who knew what in law enforcement? So that is not uninteresting. But then there are certain extremely conventional, traditional aspects of the second part, which is like, this is an account of an adjudication that are not doing anything interesting. They're not setting up from another point of view. And you do sort of wonder, like, you know, is this being made so that Jarecki and Stuart Pontier and the rest can kind of have narrative closure on this project and then finally after almost 20 years think about something else? But I don't know, and it's
potentially
not, it's not for me to tell the HBO C-suite that they shouldn't put this out, because it's, you know, like I said, it's well made, but I think it's not asking the questions of it that all of the critics are asking.
I think that's insightful. I'm you know, holding my final judgment as I sit in judgment until I've seen it all. I think it's probably still going to score a high number of magnifying glasses because it is very well made, mm-hmm. but it just doesn't, I just, I wonder about its currency and what is it talking about now? And I just think Jarecki had a fantastic opportunity to reflect on the 9 years since and on his own, blah, blah, blah. But that wasn't the thing that he wanted to do, which is fine. But it's just, I think it's almost been surpassed, and at a time it was a benchmark. It's very interesting to go back. So look, I'm not mad at it.
Well, and it's something that you've seen this year also with Serial.
Yeah.
That it's like, this was a vanguard that doesn't realize that it's been unvanguarded.
Now a rear guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's get on to this week. We watched the first four episodes of Under the Bridge. That's the 8-part scripted series on Hulu, created by Quinn Shepherd and based on the book by Rebecca Godfrey. So I'll hop straight into the crime, but, and generally we spoil everything, but as only four episodes of the 8 have dropped as we record, it'll be 5 as you listen to this podcast. And although the series is based on a true story, we will be careful about spoilers, I think, beyond the facts of the first four. So I will just say, in British Columbia in 1997, 14-year-old Rena Virk was beaten and drowned in a saltwater inlet known as the Gorge Waterway by a group of teenagers. And we won't go any further than that into the trials or convictions, if there are any, as that is ahead of us in our episodes. Sarah, I believe you have seen all 8?
I have seen all 8.
Okay. You may vaguely refer. So Rebecca Godfrey wrote a book in 2005, also called Under the Bridge, about the event, the investigations, and the outcome. And she appears as a character in the series. Before her death in 2022, she chose Riley Keough to play her, which I just found out 20 minutes ago and I thought was very interesting. Sarah, why don't you get us started with your overall thoughts on the whole series as you've seen it all? Let's not pretend you haven't.
My overall thoughts, well, I wrote about this on Best Evidence that, you know, this is a project that we had known was coming and we had known about the casting of it for a while. And it kept showing up, like when you're on these lists of like, here's the spring slate for Hulu, that it kept being pushed back or not being given a drop date. And that tends to not be a great sign. This isn't always true. But if they can't find a place to put it, or like if you're having that much trouble with this high profile a project, clearing music rights or whatever the reason is, that what I don't know is a lot. But I was concerned that we had been hearing like, oh, maybe in November of 2023, maybe in February of 2024, finally we get a drop date. And I was like, we've been waiting for this shit for a while. And I don't know. Like, I don't know what to expect. We got the screeners. I sat down and it was immediately, I mean, I hate the words immersive and propulsive in reviews, but sometimes you got to do it. And it was immersive. You got an excellent sense of place. It was shot beautifully. Riley Keough, I think it was fine in, it was Daisy Jones and the Six, right?
It was, like, yes.
That show was so forgettable, but I was like, well, she's fine. I'm just not going to keep on with that show. Just my opinion.
Same.
But she was perfect here. Every single aspect of the casting was perfect, and particularly the kids, some of whom are being called on to play either just chilling lack of empathy or, you know, imperfect victim shit that, like, when you're looking at it, you're like, oh my God, I was such a little ass to my parents when I was that age, and you're just like brought right back there. Or you're in Lily Gladstone's case, the great Lily Gladstone, who, I'm not a crackpot, she sounds a lot like Bebe Neuwirth, which is a good thing, that she's being called on to play this composite cop character who didn't necessarily, quote, exist in the real story. And that you have to, especially at this point in the true crime timeline, that if you're going to have this like protagonist law enforcement character, you got to have someone like that who projects authority, but in a thoughtful way that the viewer is going to get on her side. And the backstory of that character is, of course, complicated by a bunch of things. So I just was immediately impressed and interested. And this wasn't a story or a property that I had spent a lot of time with. So they actually had an advantage there that I could take it on its own terms and just sort of be surrounded by it if it was effective in that way, which it absolutely was. I would not characterize it as fun to watch, but
no.
Very effective. And in the like up to the middle, or sort of like until the last third, quite elliptical in the parallels that it's drawing with the Rebecca character and her past. So, I mean, yeah, it's great. It was worth waiting for. That was the headline I put on it on Best Evidence. And it was like, okay, phew. Like, not only was it worth waiting for, I actually had to stop in the middle of the screeners and force myself to like write the review and get it out. So yeah, I recommend it for sure.
Yeah. I had the same thoughts. I knew of the book. I knew the bare bones, or even like half a skeleton of what the real story was, but it was a project that was excitement and even, you know, out beyond the pale of the no screener land, I was aware of it, and we had it, you know, on our rotating list of things that we wanted to talk about for like a really long time. And like you, I thought, what's wrong with it?
Right.
Are there legal issues? Is it just not very good? Are they reshooting? What's happening?
Yeah.
So it is a bit of a...
when a house has been on the market for a while,
yeah,
and then the price goes down and you're like, but there's four bathrooms. Is this shit haunted? What's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you go to a department store and there are clothes on sale, you've got to ask yourself, why are these on sale? But for some reason, this isn't on sale. This should be full price, should be premium price. I mean, I have a few thoughts which we'll get into that take away very, very slightly. Well, not even take away. They're just things I went, yes, I would have done that differently. But I waited for four to pile up because I thought I could with our timing of when we were going to talk about it. And I literally came to the end of the fourth one and went, where are the other three episodes I'm supposed to be watching? It's not fast by any means. And I like your use of the word elliptical, because we get the death or apparent death really early. I thought, how can we have like seven more episodes? Is the investigation so complex? But then it just swings back and there's this little girl who we'd been mourning as dead, and there she is being a little biatch to her mother. And the swings backwards and forwards of her alive, her dead, her alive, her dead, or her alive, her missing, her alive, her dead. I thought that's such a fantastic evocation of grief as well, how the timeline around someone's death when you're in it, and then when you get past it, is, did that happen then? Were they still alive? Do I imagine this happening with them? So I thought that was particularly powerful. And yeah, you've opened the door. So let's talk about the insertion of Rebecca Godfrey into the series and the creation of Cam Bentland, who is the character that Lily Gladstone plays. And it immediately reminded me of The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which as we speak, premiere tonight on Stan. Everybody has to watch it. It's brilliant. It's an adaptation of the book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, and the supremely talented screenwriter who wrote the series insisted on putting the writer of the book into the television series as a sort of now and then kind of balance. And so it reminded me so much of that. And I thought, this is so interesting. Now, this is current. This is contemporary. Because it's saying, who are these people who are inscribing the stories, writing the book, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, from a memory told to her, writing the book Under the Bridge as a journalist going back to a place where she herself had been a troubled teen. She herself had had a death of her brother. So what did you think, narratively and thematically, of both putting Rebecca Godfrey into the story and not changing her name, and creating Lily Gladstone's character, Cam, and then making a relationship, a previous relationship with them, which complicates the issues?
Well, as the series goes on, as the episodes unfold, they make the subtext a bit more text in terms of the appropriate or inappropriate nature of Godfrey sort of involving herself with this story and the ways in which she embeds with these kids. And I was not, as much as I liked that they just sort of let the viewer get there on her own in the early going, I was less of a fan of them kind of, you know, clicking the desk lamp on over that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And agreed. Particularly in this, you know, one event in Godfrey's past, which, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler, the circumstances around the brother's death are like remain pretty murky throughout, sort of literally. So I apologize if that was inappropriate, that adjective, but I think that what they are good at is not over emphasizing this idea that ideas about objectivity in like documentary or like narrative nonfiction, that there's this idea that in a documentary or a reported book or story that, you know, objectivity and just sort of a straight transcript of events is prioritized over a more messy, firsthand, like diaristic account. And what does it, you know, why do we believe a law enforcement version of that that isn't necessarily any more, quote, objective or truthful? Like who do we believe, who do we listen to, and what are we telling ourselves about who we choose when we choose, perhaps not even consciously, but like which accounts do we quote rely on as truthful, and is that a mistake? Is that incorrect? Because I think that this depiction of Rebecca Godfrey is at times like frustrating, maddening, like she can be self-destructive, or, you know, if you're a journalist or a critic and you see her putting herself into a given situation to kind of get closer to her subjects, you're like, you know, but now you're compromised. Okay, but is she? Why do I think that? What is more important, getting these 15-year-olds who fucking idolize John Gotti
with
their bubbly handwriting to trust her, or her being sort of like, I don't know, like rigidly doctrinaire about the interview process and the embedding process? So there are much larger comments on objectivity and its relationship to, quote, truth as we understand it, that are not asterisked. And I really liked that also, because I had to like pause it at one point and just sort of unspool my own thoughts and my notes about like, why is this character so uncomfortable at times for me to watch? when she's just like at some red solo cup party with these kids. So you're what are you doing?
Yes, but then it's like, very distressing.
Why is that my reaction? Yeah. So I thought that was a solid choice. Cam Bentland is sort of like, if they had had anyone else playing her, I don't know. But there's a, it's interesting, like there's a similar, it was a TV movie about the Thalia Massey case from the 80s, and I reviewed it like a couple months ago. And there's a, they did a similar thing with a composite cop character who was played by Kris Kristofferson, and it was like, this has no fucking business working at all. But it's Kris Kristofferson. He can really wear that hat. He really wants to bone Sean Young, and you buy it. You buy all of it, and it's like sometimes
who amongst us?
When they're trying to get over with a character like this, it's like, well, they cast it correctly.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'm not proud of it, but I'm going with it because it's Lily Gladstone. So,
yes.
I don't know. What did you think of the, what's the phrase I want? When it came to the Rebecca Godfrey, quote, character, what did you think of her, sort of nuanced, like, what did you think of the frustrating verite qualities of this character? Let's put it that way.
I mean, I went on a bit of an interesting journey, and we were just talking about the Jinx and Jarecki, who appears, lest we forget, quite a lot in part one and is apparently going to appear even more in part two. So when we see Rebecca, when she is a character, is she us? So we go, okay, that I'm comfortable. I have found the person who was me, who was going to go into the story and be me, and she will be my narrator and my guide. And almost immediately she's not, which I loved, absolutely loved. And almost immediately journalistic integrity out the window. But is it? Am I just wanting to have this idea, or have I been fed this idea that journalistic integrity can only be arm's length, scrupulous, heartless, bloodless, All the President's Men, fantastic movie based on real life. But that idea of journalists, these two men searching for the truth, ironclad, not getting involved emotionally, but the truth itself being this kind of ambrosia that you're going for. And that is not the Rebecca Godfrey character. Whether it was Rebecca Godfrey herself, I don't know, but she was involved. So some kind of blessing was passed on. I loved her arriving home. I loved that I understood her relationship with her mother immediately. Her mother having made all the food but not coming out of the kitchen to hug her. They got that family relationship so right that then her, I was going to say quirks, they weren't quirks, faults of going blindly into this world of these teenage girls before she knows what they've done, the potential damage that she can do, how we see the girl, the character whose name is Josephine Bell in the series, played by Chloe Gaudry, fantastic acting here. And, you know, her desire, oh, you come from New York. I want to go to New York. I want to go with Gotti. I want to be a made woman. It's like, that's not how the mafia works. But her childishness.
The idea that all New Yorkers know each other.
Exactly.
So Becca can just like, let's hop in the car and go to his social club. Like, that's not.
And that idea of I can stay with you, the naivety of that, along with the, what my mother would have called, very knowing. She thought the girls who were bad influences on me were very knowing. Little did she know that I was the bad influence, not the other girls. But putting that character of Josephine against the Rebecca character and her immediately diving in, immediately making promises that she has no business making, immediately holding out a hope to this poor damaged child, this dangerous damaged child, without protecting herself, the family, the children. I was a whirl, but I also loved it because it smashes that idea of you can't be a journalist if you get involved. You can't be a journalist if, you know, we sit on Law and Order. Oh, you can't investigate this case because it's too close to something that happened in your real life. But nobody's saying that to Rebecca, whose brother drowned, and she's investigating the drowning of a teen herself. Why shouldn't she? Why wouldn't it make her more invested? So I'm really fascinated by that idea of, you know, we love the flawed hero, but this goes beyond a flawed hero. She's not even a hero. And then you put her against, however you want to say it, this Cam Bentland character, the gift of casting Lily Gladstone. That is a gift from Lily to the filmmakers, not the other way around. And the complexity that she brings just by being in a show. But it's more than that. She's thought very much, I read an interview with her where she brings the Indigenous nature of the character is Indigenous because she's Indigenous. Wasn't necessarily written as an Indigenous character, but it now is because she is. And she talks about the bridge under which Rena died as being a bridge between Crown land and Indigenous land. And even though you don't need those facts, you have that. Then she's adopted by a white family. Just anyway, stunning. Love that. My one little hiccup was the introduction of her and her brother and her father and their boxing. And I thought very much of a podcaster I listen to quite a lot by the name of Sarah D. Bunting, who says, "Didn't you have any siblings? Couldn't you write a sibling relationship?" I don't know if more happens after episode 4, but I find their sibling relationship under-interesting, whether it's underwritten or I don't know.
Yeah, they needed to either do more with that or not do it.
Not do it at all, yeah.
Although...
Yeah, I don't know why we need him. I don't know why we need
Daniel Deemer as her brother Scott was good. And, you know, the great Matt Craven... seen in like almost everything. Absolutely
superb casting. Guy, but yeah,
playing her, you know, the police chief and her adoptive father, and the way that he communicated, I think generations of the frustrations that adopted people have with the unexamined. The unexamined lives of their adopters. Like, he has one thing that's like, I don't know, that she's trying to like get promoted in her career, which means that she will be leaving this community. And he has just a, like, I forget which episode it's in, but he has just a drive-by comment about like, and off you'll go to the big city because you think you're better than us. And the subtext is like, you know, after everything we've done for you.
Yes.
It's like, ugh. I mean, so much of this.
Biological parents can pull that one as well, but yeah, like, how much more of a sting is it from an adoptive father?
Yes. I mean, see, my father still being like, do you, you know, I'll sell you the house for $1. Like, I can't. No, I'm not going back to New Jersey. I can't carry the property taxes. Sorry, you raised a poet.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The number of ways in which this story is about children being left. Like left in the past, left in a puddle, left at a group home, left out of investigations and conversations about their own futures. Just, it was really fairly subtly done. But just the way that children are like left behind and not heard in so many ways in this story, but that the story then lets you hear from them, good and bad, is really well done. And not easy. Yeah. It's not easy to do, even if you set yourself that task. It's not easy to do.
While not losing sight of the victim.
Right.
I mean, we always want victim-centered. And if you haven't seen it and you're just listening to us, first of all, stop and go and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But we never forget Rena. We never forget it, because she's either on the screen or in our minds, because we are urging people who don't know things to find them out, things that we know that they don't know. There's a very judicious doling out of information. We don't want to be too far ahead of the characters, because then they're, you know, a bit so stupid and bubbling. But we don't want to be too far behind them, because then we feel stupid and bumbling. So I think there's it's not a knife edge, but it's quite a narrow, it's quite a narrow beam that's being walked here, and it gives an excitement which is belied by much of the pace being not frenetic. And then you have children running through the night desperately,
right,
afraid or violent, that smashes through, but then back to quite a stately pace, which I really liked. You have Rena exploding at her parents.
What did you think of the pacing of the flashbacks? Because I was specifically impressed by, look, nobody likes the, you know, you see a scene and then it's like title card 4 days earlier that you're like, oh, for Christ's sake, like, can everyone just not do that for a period of 16 to 18 months?
Moratorium, 18 months, no title cards. Thank you.
But the way they do it here, like, you get so used to this more traditional, like, we're going to start with this. Here's the whatever, the crime scene. And then we're going to flash back to this time and then step forward to this time. As you said before, the way that it kind of zigzags through the timeline does reflect the way that grief can zigzag. But also, sometimes they just go back and they're like, 10 months before. And then the scene is like 90 seconds long or 2 minutes long, instead of that more stately, like, here's where we are and here's how you can tell it's a different time because everybody's like roots are a different length or whatever. Like, they're not as cute about that. Like, since we went back to this timeline, we're going to use all the footage we shot and it's going to be 5 minutes. Like, nobody cares. But then there's also an episode about Rena Virk's and the Virk family's coming to Canada, how they integrated or tried to with like white Canadian culture. And that those, I was like, well, I don't know, like, did you just like get these bell bottoms and you felt like we had to spend time here? But then that winds up adding to the dimensions, I thought. So the use of moving around in the timeline and flashbacks, it usually makes me so impatient. So it was particularly impressive here that they had such a sure touch with how long we were going to spend in various whens. Did you agree?
Yeah, for the most part, I think it's very, very judicious and illuminating. And it just, it's so clever too, because every time we see Rena, particularly after we know she's dead, I mean, we know she's going to die from the start because we're watching the show, we have some idea about it, but let's say. So that every time it flashes back and we see her face, this child, this 14-year-old child who's so unmoored from her family, trying to find out where she belongs. She isn't blonde. She isn't white. She isn't slim. That's the ideal. Because Josephine Bell is like that and she is the ideal. So every time we flash back and we see her alive and we see her face, it's just heart-stopping. So I liked that. I agree about the title cards. If you do it well enough, we know when it is. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it sort of doesn't matter if it's 4 days or 10 days or 2 months. We get the idea. What I do think they did well is it's not necessarily immediately obvious why we've gone back to look at a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the detective finds a necklace, flashback, the mother gives the child a necklace. It's not that. But it's like this cross illumination from forwards and backwards, which I really like. And in fact, the title cards interfere with. Don't tell me when it is. I'll figure it out. Like, I do trust you as the filmmakers. I wanted to talk about the character of Raj Masihaja, played by Anoop Desai. He's Rena's uncle. And I thought for a while that he would be almost taking over some narration from Rebecca Godfrey. Not literal narration, but that we might be following him. Again, no. That was dangled. And then smashed. He is her friend and for us almost her only friend. Perhaps she thinks that as well. And he also seems to have taken on the burden of family spokesperson. And I thought this was such a fascinating role to not exactly illuminate, but to have, to spend time with, for the writers to allow us to spend time with him, because that is a very difficult role that we don't often see. I mean, role in real life, the family spokesman.
And I think also that, speaking of judicious, this is an actor who, I mean, there's a couple of actors here that are like household names, I guess, like Archie Punjabi as Suman Virk, who is Rena's mom, Lily Gladstone, of course, Riley Keough, of course, and, you know, some others that it's like, oh, I've seen such and so, like Matt Craven is a, hey, it's that guy. But Anoop Desai is a better known person, I would say. So your assumption is that this person has been cast to be used, to be on the screen, to locate you in the story in this like extra textual way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really not used the way you would expect. You would think that he would be on screen more. You would think he would like have a VO. You would think that he and Rebecca are going to end up sort of like teaming up in some way. And it, like he acts it extraordinarily well, that this is a person who probably could be a bridge himself between Rena and her own story, using Rebecca, between law enforcement and this, you know, quote, girl gang that I think the Canadian press went a little overboard with that, you know, cardboard cutout of a motivation. But he just is himself. Like, he's not a, quote, character that is used for something. He's just himself. Like, he could be a connector, and sometimes he is, but not in a not in that way that you're expecting, having seen, you know, many docudramas and many miniseries, and just sort of being like, oh, because I recognize that actor, he's going to take the audience's hand in a way that he doesn't really. Not that he's not good or well used, he is. It's just not what you expect. And that's
exactly
what I really always kept thinking of when I was watching Under the Bridge, was they're following the story as the story wants to be told.
Yes,
they're
absolutely.
Not following the rhythms of.
Mm-hmm. He's not Mr.
Not
Exposition.
Like traditional. Yeah, it's not a by numbers thing. They're not necessarily doing. They're telling the story as the story wants to be told, and like listening to what the story is telling them to do, in a way that I have not actually read the book yet, but I think that that is a feature of the book. Certainly, people I've spoken to who have read it, like, I think that there's just this idea of like listening to women and girls.
Yes.
And certainly this is in its bones. It understands what I call girl world. I, you know, kept thinking back to Heavenly Creatures.
Yes.
And how that understood this like world that you can't necessarily translate. But if I say girl world, and it's like, why doesn't she just stop being friends with them? They're so mean to her. Like, oh,
spoken like you were never a teenage girl.
Got
if
it.
You can ask that question, you were never a teenage girl. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this I thought was a sort of a bit of quiet stunningness, this use of the uncle character. He could have been Mr. Exposition. He could have been the one that the police come to, and he can explain the family. Oh, yes, when we immigrated in.
Yeah.
And I think it's he as a character is as he wishes and needs to be, and not a chess piece that a lesser writer can move around. Again,
right. Just so.
Employing a great actor to do it. So I was so impressed from the big characters to the medium, to the girls and girl world, as you say, with how nothing is the formula of how to do this, and everything is exactly as you say, the story as the story wants to be told.
Yeah. And these young actors, I mean, just blown away, truly. Like, they're all doing exactly what they need to do. Like, what thoughtful performances from such young people, but also cast for that. You know, I spent a lot of time with fucking C+ teen dramas of the 90s in other parts
you do.
Of my working life.
Yes, you do.
And it's like a, you know,
it's your burden.
Fucking 26, I can tell. But the reason you can tell is that there are moments. There are moments here, Chloe Guidry as Josephine Bell, and particularly Javon Wana Walton as Warren Glowatzky.
Yes.
Where there are certain shots where the 6-year-old and the 26-year-old that they're going to be are coexisting in these like round faces that, and you know, it's not just their faces, it's acting as well, that their ability to communicate the, you know, the fullness of these people that they haven't even yet become. And then there's one character who is just bad. She's just bad seed, and she's perfect also.
And when we find out, it's like, oh, she was right there and I didn't see her.
Yeah.
So good. And they didn't see her either.
I mean, I know it's such a cliche to be like, oh, the, you know, shark eyes of the killer, but like she does it. I mean, you know, there's Josephine, who Chloe Guidry, 92% of the time, you want to slap her bloody, but then that 8%, you're just like, oh my gosh, this poor
child.
Child's.
Yeah.
And her territorial scrabbling and gaudy aspirations.
Yes. and the idea, and you just really see how young she is with this idea of this woman she's never met who lives in New York is going to take her to New York. It's and she embodies all of that. She embodies all
but
of that.
But it's like, if you think about it, it is sort of like believing in Santa.
Yes.
I mean, you know, gangster Santa, but Santa is like, oh, are you going to take me to the North Pole? And you're like, this is both terrifying and so, so pitiful. And at the same time,
it's the right word.
Property's ability to see 360 degrees of its characters and just like show us that and accept it is really something. And it's what you want. It's what you're always complaining about true crime for, is so that the narrative, like the storytelling, will be brought to heel culturally and just be like, just let people fucking be who they are. Everybody's a fuck up. Who cares? I mean, it's great. It's great. It's not perfect, but it's great.
So this is based on two books, primarily Under the Bridge by Rebecca Godfrey from 2005. I too haven't read it, but I will. I know a bookshop where I might be able to get it.
It is almost never in, and it goes right back out the door. It happened last week again. People don't sell it, but I'll keep an eye out for you.
Thank you. And the other book is Rena, A Father's Story by Manjit Phirk from 2008. So before we get to our magnifying glasses, ring, ring, someone's at the door.
I'm going to give Under the Bridge 4.5 magnifying glasses. I think it brilliantly unfolds how the crime was committed in a way that's both easy to understand, but also with a little bit of mystery. I think Lily Gladstone is amazing in her role as Officer Cam. And the only thing I would knock about it is the inclusion of author Rebecca Godfrey's character, played by Riley Kehoe. I understand that the show is based on her book, and I get that, but I feel the character doesn't bring as much to the show as it should. But other than that, I think the pacing is wonderful. I think the in-depth character studies of all the people involved is really good. And I think this property was very much worth the wait, since we've known about it for over a year now. I just would like to thank Sarah and SDB for keeping the show going while I'm gone. Thank you to our listeners who keep sticking with us. And I will hope to see everybody soon when I get back.
Thanks, Mari. Sarah, what about you? How many magnifying glasses are you going to give this series? And do rate the entire 8 episodes.
The entire 8, I'm allowed to do halves, right?
Yep. Yeah,
like 4 and then the stalk of a fifth. I'm going to go 4.5 because in the sort of back third, I would say blinks a little bit and starts not becoming more expository, but it's like it needed to make sure that we understood what it was doing, which it did not need to do. But with that said, I mean, if I had to pick, I would say 5, but since I can do halves, I'm going to do 4.5. And the acting is like a 7. So definitely recommend, but I'm going to go with 4.5. What about you?
Look, I'm going to do 4.5 too for the first 4. I mark it down slightly because as I mentioned, the character of Cam's brother and the introduction and the rivalry seemed a hat on a hat. Because she already has the adversarial, loving relationship with her father that's switching backwards and forwards. And I don't know that we need a dumb jock brother policeman there as well. It may be explicated further in the back 4. I don't know. But I think from what I've said, you, the listener, can tell I liked it very much. So I'm giving it 4.5. So, Sarah, what do you have to recommend to our listeners today?
Well, to my surprise, and I'm actually not sure where you're going to find this, But there are a couple of social media accounts that are like, what's about to play next on Turner Classic Movies? So if you're here in the States and you have that on your cable system, follow those social media accounts. This, I think, is probably your best chance to watch this film for free. I believe I rented it on Amazon Prime. It's called Butterfield 8.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the early 60s, starring Elizabeth Taylor. She's starring as an adapted version, I guess, of a real woman named, of all things, Star Faithful, which was a true story that like captivated the nation in the 30s. She's kind of a more like late, like Eisenhower era idea of the quote, good time girl. And I'm slowly working my way through this book by Harold Schechter called Ripped from the Headlines, which is a compendium of books or of movies that you might not have realized were based on real cases. Butterfield 8 is one of them. I don't have a ton of patience usually with Liz Taylor as an actor. I just think there's like too much other shit going on and it's an acting style I don't love. Plus, in this one, Eddie Fisher is one of her co-stars, and there's a whole like meta swirl of they forced the studio to cast him. You can tell. But she's actually really good. And there are also meta layers of what society thought in two different previous eras about sex work, about trauma, about believing women, basically. It's not great, this movie, but it's so much better than I expected. And it really set me off on this like wool gathering path of like, if only Liz Taylor had had a more like, this is completely wild as a comp, but like a more Caitlin Dever career where she had been doing more of this in this genre. And like, I wish we'd seen her in more like TV movies and miniseries about real cases, because I think she brought both way too much to it and something special. So Butterfield 8, it's too long. You're really going to know every possible thing about her boobs. But that's a value add for some people. But if you can find a way to watch it for free, it's not currently available for free on streaming, but keep an eye on TCM. You never know when they're going to get the rights to it. And I recommend it. It really has something to say about like mid-century attitudes about post-crime trauma. And it's worth a look. And it's like just beautiful to look at. God, this mid-century design.
Mm.
Every single, like the tabletop lighter with a wick. Amazing. Gorgeous. What about you?
Shop
what
the
you
screen. Well, I reached back into the past as well. We're in the crime scene time machine today. Mm-hmm. I went back to 1948 to Rope, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Jimmy Stewart. One of my favorite films of all time. And it happens to be inspired by the true story of thrill killers Leopold and Loeb themselves from 1924. They wanted to demonstrate their superior intellect by committing the perfect crime without consequences. And Rope updates the time period and has the two host a dinner party in their apartment, dining on a chest which holds the body of their school chum that they have just strangled. It's black and white. It's one set. It's one single tracking shot. It's not actually. It's four. You won't notice any of the cuts. This is Alfred Hitchcock.
But watching along to see if you can spot them is part of the fun. It's so good. I've seen that one like so many times.
Oh,
it holds up. And
it's so good.
Foxy in it.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. I was looking at my favorite rip from the headlines adapted movies. You know, I mentioned All the President's Men from the 70s, along with something like Dog Day Afternoon. When I was starting to go to the movies, when I was starting to see at least three or four a week, when you had to go to revival houses to see older material. This is before video, everybody, which was a revelation to us. And all of them. French Connection, wonderful, formative movies for me. But, and I thought, I'm just going to recommend one. And I thought, I actually can't not recommend Rope, because it looks at crime. What is crime? Why is crime? Why have they done the crime? Why don't we like crime? And those thoughts that Alfred Hitchcock was entertaining and always wanted to be an entertainer. But he also made you think, and also it's beautiful. Like, it's absolutely beautiful. And you go, oh, that's why black and white works.
Yeah. It really does feel, you can almost taste it. Like the, you know, filterless tobacco experience of, of black and white. Stewart is fantastic, as he always is. One of these days I'm going to have to run my best evidence true crime resume percentage on him.
Oh, yes,
he's got a lot of true crime on his resume, and he too is perfect casting. Yeah. But I also need to do a piece one day about whether Leopold and Loeb are the most adapted or inspiring, like, not a great word, you need something more pejorative, of all time in terms of major case, because I just feel like multiple Law and Orders have done it, multiple movies have done it,
there's a play that
speaks to so many anxieties about elites, about sexuality, about sociopathy, and whether we can detect it, who will, you know, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Mm-hmm. Like, of the 1920s. So I think that is the most homaged case in fictional film and TV.
I wonder if you're right, and you might be. There's the idea, because they just took this boy, a young boy, for no reason, in Bobby inverted
Franks,
commas.
May he rest.
And in the movie, it's a school chum. But it's still like they just picked him again for no reason. And that's part of their MO, is like, well, one of the reasons we're going to get away with it is because we're smarter than everybody, but also because we want to murder someone, but not that particular someone for any reason. So I think the story also vibrates that for us, that we can conceive of someone killing us or attacking us because they hate us or they're jealous or they want our wallet or something like that. But not that it was just you for no reason. And I think that's terrifying. And I think that's what Rope gets to. It's available on Prime in the US and for rent on Apple TV Plus in Australia. At Crime Scene, we're eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. And please remember to subscribe to our feed. robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. It makes a big difference. Sarah, what have you got going on, and where can the people find you?
Well, as noted, I do run an all true crime bookshop that includes magazines and ephemera. I do have some new books, but mostly secondhand, and that's called Exhibit B Books. You can find that on socials at Exhibit B Books. And to you Crime Scene listeners, get your own discount code, 15% off. That's XCS15. Enter that at checkout, get 15% off. Come on through. I'd love to see you. XCS15 for 15% off. That's it.
Buy those true crime books and send them as recommendations to us. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Book search is free and I'm happy to help. So, mash that chat button. It's what I do.
Fantastic. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine on all the things. Over on Silent Podcasts, Naomi Calhoun and I are covering season 17 of Taskmaster UK. And Sam Smith from The Traitors New Zealand and I are covering The Traitors Quebec, despite neither of us speaking French. The podcast is called What Did They Francais? We'd love it if you'd have a listen. So, Sarah, what are we watching next week?
Well, Sarah, next week we are watching Control Alt Desire on Paramount Plus. I have some doubts based on that title, but we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it with my co-host on The Docket, Eve Beatty, who who has, I believe, been a crime scene guest before. So we're getting that band back together.
She's a two-timer.
Control Alt Desire, and that's on Paramount Plus.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Sarah, for the beginning of your reign in that warm chair. She'll be here all month, folks. Thanks to Will from America for the theme music and the whole RHAP team behind the scenes. Until next time, okay, bye-bye.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.